Robert Louis Stevenson wrote this little poem. It seemed fitting for the end of the year. Dark brown is the river, golden is the sand. It flows along forever with trees on either hand. Green leaves a-floating, castles on the foam, boats of mine go a-boating. Where will all come home? On goes the river and out past the mill, away down the valley, away down the hill. Away down the river, 100 miles or more, other little children shall bring my boats ashore. Every year on about the 7th of December, my wife Elspeth and I have the same conversation at home. She says, it's time to bring up the Christmas decorations. And I say, hopefully, which ones? And she says, all of them. And I think, no, I have to face the dreaded locker. The locker. I'm so unfamiliar with the locker that I even have the combination to the combination lock written in pencil on the locker door so I don't forget it. That's how unfamiliar I am with the scene in the basement. But down I go and stack up bags and boxes of everything that looks Christmassy and put it on a little roller and bring it upstairs. And after about 20 minutes, she says, that's all I need. And there is one little ball and one little star picked out. And the place looks a bit scant but lovely. And she says, now you can take it all back down again. And so I do. We're putting away Christmas soon. Indeed, many of us have put it away already. The culture certainly has moved. There are now sales on everything. I was in a supermarket the other day, and I found those big, big boxes of Christmas cookies, you know, the ones with the chocolate on them and the icing on them, the huge box from overseas, $3.95. If I hadn't pigged out over the whole season, I would have bought 10. But I'd bought 10 already on December the 7th to get over the conversation with my wife. Well, there are sales everywhere, buying the ends of things, things that didn't sell over the Christmas rush, and you can begin to see Christmas trees lying out sort of forlornly by the side of the road. And our thoughts turn to New Year's lists, don't they? The worst of this, the best of that, the best dress, the worst political speech, things that movie stars said, those who died, those who lived. We'll be looking at them over the next few days. But of course, there is more to Christmas than simply executing a season and then putting it away. Christmas enters our collective souls like water dripping into a garden and enriches them over years and years of living. Suddenly, all my Christmases blend together. I was thinking of one this morning, one in which I was a little boy, about 7 years old, and I'd asked my mother for a cat for Christmas. Well, I raced down at the crack of dawn, went in and looked under the tree, and there was the shape of a cat there, two little cat's ears, and my heart sang until I realized it was a cat piggy bank, and I was supposed to save my pennies from then on. And I remember my little girl, Rosalyn, at about a year old, just past her birth and into her first Christmas, coming down the stairs one little tentative step at a time, turning and seeing the tree and her eyes lighting in a way which I have never forgotten. She's now 46 years old, and the memory of her coming down those stairs is fresh in my mind. Well, I remember late services. I remember services wonderful in this church over the years. We'll carry them with me wherever I go. There are layers of beloved things. As I considered this reality and thumbed through my own Christmases in my own life, I could not help but recall the strange story found in the writings of the book of Jeremiah. It seems unfitting for this particular day, but then I realized how deeply fitting it was. The situation was an invasion, and the foreign troops were pouring into the land. The king was frantic, those who were considered to be fifth columnists, perhaps working against the government, were being watched and were suspect, as is always the case. And Jeremiah, being outspoken, was thought to be a traitor. He was hated by those in power and feared by his neighbors. He spent a lot of time alone, gathering his thoughts, wondering how to speak the things that were essential for him to say, even in these chaotic times, when one afternoon there was a knock on the door and a long-lost cousin came in, hat in hand, and said, "We have a family problem." And Jeremiah said, "What is it?" He said, "Well, remember old Uncle Reuben?" "Uncle Reuben, Uncle Reuben, and Uncle Reuben, yes, we used to see him at the family reunions, lives a long way away." "Yes, yes, well, Uncle Reuben died. We just got the message. And remember that little farm he used to have, the little farmstead away out there? Didn't grow much, a bit of scrub land. Well, it's right in the middle of the war zone, and there's no one else to claim it. And if someone in the family doesn't claim it, we're going to lose it." "Well, I'm not going to claim it," said the cousin. "No one in the family is. We're barely scraping by with this war on and all." And after a few moments of thought, the prophet Jeremiah said, "Well, I'll take it. I'll take it." And he ordered two deeds to be drawn. One was a public deed saying he owned the thing and had paid for it, and he would carry that with him on his person even through the time of troubles. And the other was a deed absolutely alike, which he would then bury safely in the ground so that down the years family members could dig it up and know that they belonged to that land and it belonged to them, a legacy far after the wars were over. Now, there's something about the Christmas story to me in that piece of land. If we push it too hard, Christmas, that is, in the war zone in which we live, the war zone of ideas and ideologies and all the rest, if we push Jesus is Lord, the Christ is born, too hard in the culture in which we live, we end up in fights and divisions. It happens. But to let it go, to let the farmstead go in the midst of the battles, just to let it drift, is to lose something so significant in our souls, so significant in our family history, that it seems an absolute waste. Well, it's amazing where the help in these questions comes from. I was reading an article the other day by Margaret Atwood. In it, she calls herself a strict agnostic. Indeed, she says she comes from Mars when it comes to the confusion and profusion of Christian witnesses. A good start. And yet she writes, "These are extremely varied, these Christian witnesses. You'll see a Quaker is quite different from a Russian Orthodox patriarch, and that an Ethiopian Coptic is entirely distinct from a Pentecostal or an Irish Catholic or a Mormon or a Christian Scientist or a social justice Christian from Sojourners from the Salvation Army or the Mennonite International Service Committee. They have nothing in common with a member of the cross-burning member of the Ku Klux Klan. The question is, as Humpty Dumpty asked in Alice in Wonderland, who is the master?" Who is the master? That's what hooked me. That's the question the world is asking of the circus. Who is the ringmaster here when all is said and done? We always have more than three rings running in this world at any time. Just watch the news. Just read the newspapers. There are clowns in the aisle and aerial artists swinging around above us, and there are hawkers at the gates. So who is the master? Who is the one who is operating the schedule and sending the acts in as they need to appear? Well, the letter to the Galatians was written under the watchful eye of Rome and was wise enough only to hint at who the master is. The writer of Galatians said, "There is something in you when your soul is awake that will know that the master is near." I thought that was a very interesting thought. If you are rejoicing, you are close to the master. If you feel yourself rejoicing about something, you know that the object which caused the rejoicing is very near. Have you been in love? Remember not being able to wait to see your loved one more time? Can you imagine the time dragging all day until the evening would come and you would be together? And then when you were there, the time would simply fly by. The feeling of the beloved indicated in you without question that the beloved was near, the recognition of the master through a feeling. Can you recall the delights of a fancy occasion? And in that occasion, you were in the presence of the master. Does the feeling ever go away? I was thinking this morning of the veranda space outside Casa Loma. Some of you may have walked on it. In 1963, I strode out under the stars with my high school sweetheart, and we danced cheek to cheek to the orchestra out on the foyer of Casa Loma. I've been out there many times since, and she's not there. But when I think about it, the feeling of the delight of the stars overhead and someone I loved in my arms brings it all back. The feeling brings the presence of the master. And if you've been caught up in the rituals and the reveries of a wedding, you know you are close to the master. I was thinking I've married over 1,500 couples over the last 48 years, but it's very different when you're on the other end of the groom's ring. When my wife Elspeth and I were married in 1980, it was an afternoon wedding at my suburban church. I think many of the congregation didn't know that my first wife and I were in marital difficulties, and I announced 2 weeks later that I was being married. Well, we had 100 people at the morning service and 400 people at the wedding. People brought their lunch, they brought their family members, and small pets they were raising from infants. Elspeth came in, took one look down the aisle, and said, "Nope, not for me." I should have listened. There she was, absolutely beautiful, and son David walking her down the aisle. Well, the parkway was closed, as I recall, and it was wedding time, and my friend David McCain, who married us, was not there yet, and suddenly he swung into the parking lot on two wheels, jumped out of the car in his cassock, and a great armful of colored balloons raced down the aisle, started the ceremony, and I started to hyperventilate. And my wife elbowed me right in the ribs. They're starting to heal. And it's been that way ever since. Hyperventilation, a little shot in the ribs. We call it marriage. And you know you're in the presence of the beloved of the master. Well, that's the way it is, isn't it? Luke tells us that you see the master sometimes in the landscape. For example, he says, if you see a spent field, look closer, it may be a sign of the master. And he told us about Simeon, a man who had lived a long life and who had loved and explored and adored and knew both joy and sorrow, as many, many old men know. And yet, even in the temple confines, he was able to see and discern new things, true things, with old eyes, a spent field that was not spent. The simple ritual of the blessing of a child stirred in him a richness he had almost forgotten, a richness which this young couple did not even realize how rich it was. And he went and spoke to them, and the old connected with the new. What you are doing here is restoring the tribe. What you are doing here is launching your child into a destiny which belongs to your child and to God. It is a most remarkable thing. Oh, there will be sadness, and there will be distance, and there will be loss, and there will be times when you aren't sure how this is all supposed to go, but you are being carried safely in the hands of a spirit who has brought you to this moment. It's in us. It's in us to recognize greatness, even if we feel we are a spent field. Well, there was Anna as well. I think Luke would call her a fallow field at this point. Anna, long widowed, perhaps even childless, her place in the tribe diminished by her age and station. And yet she saw the child and held the child in her arms and gave a sense of the parents of the meaning of this baby from where they were in their life to where that child might go. Do you have that in your life? An old fallow field, an old woman, a grandmother, perhaps a neighbor up the street, someone who simply lived, and you sit down with a cup of tea or with a cookie and a conversation or even in the silence, and you recognize in that person there is a whole life that has been lived, and the richness of that life is profound, and it has something to do with you, and in the presence of that person, your life is profoundly safe. What a gift. But what about the other deed, the one buried for the future? What is its value, I wonder? Again, Margaret Atwood comes to our aid. She writes, "The core of Christianity is surely the teaching of its founder, namely, love your neighbor as yourself, love your enemies, whoever said that before, the forgiveness of sins, the spirit as opposed to the letter, and the rebirth of the spirit." Here is Margaret Atwood, an agnostic and self-declared Martian in the presence of the faithful, bearing witness to the power of the true master, the one that will still be true long, long down the years after all the wars. Listen, loving your neighbor as yourself. Simple, intentional good-heartedness wherever you go. Personal vulnerability in the presence of another beyond culture and clan. Do you do it? Do you know how powerfully rich it is? I shop in the same supermarket every week, and a couple of times a week drive in there. It's on the way home, and you go through the parking stall, and there's the parking attendant sitting in a little booth in the cold, and I wave to him on the way in, and on the way out, as I'm showing him my parking slip, I have a 2-minute conversation with him. "Hi, how is your day going so far? Are you ready for the big city?" Whatever the conversation is, it takes 2 minutes. He smiles, I smile, and somehow this person is a friend, and he's not just a figure in a box, some little servant doing something I need to get me from inside to outside. A little moment of loving your neighbor as yourself. It is so easy and so rich, and under that underground parking lot, I suddenly have a friend. "Loving your enemies," she writes. "Say goodbye to the nuclear arsenal, ethnic cleansing, the ravaging of the land, the hoarding of wealth, self-driven futures, seeing beyond the rage of things to a new day. It has to happen. It has to happen in Syria. It has to happen in Iran. It has to happen among First Nations people. It has to happen among refugees who've been forced out of their homes and are on the road. It has to happen in our own hardened hearts where hatred has taken the place of something far more beautiful." Oh, it's difficult to do, but loving your neighbors, loving your enemies as your neighbors is a profound and transformative thing that brings the master near. It's in the deed further down the road. Forgiveness of sins, being merciful to yourself. It's happened to you. The thing is real. Given a choice, you might have chosen something else, but you didn't. All right, all right. Go easy on yourself. You're still worthy. You're still here. It is not absolutely the end of the world, the forgiveness of sins. How many of us are bearing burdens because we will simply not allow the forgiveness of sins to be real? And then the one that trapped me the most, the spirit of things as opposed to the letter of things. Let the colors be brighter than the pattern indicates. Let the way be more mysterious than the open road seems initially. Be enthralled rather than in charge of things. Err on the side of yes every time you can. The spirit of things as opposed to the letter of it. And it's all empowered, says Margaret Atwood, all empowered by a great spirit within us and beyond us. That's the thing that brings us here. We argue over religion and over religious differences. Religions and the structures we build to create them are simply a response to something. It is the something that is alive and holds us in its loving hands. It is the something that signs the deed and leads us where we need to go. The early church is delivered to us as a deed. Somebody planted it in the ground centuries ago for us to dig up and to know it is ours. And we exercise our faith here and in this time, and in so doing are burying the second deed in the ground that others down the road who have never even yet been born will discover our writing, our handprints, our fingerprints on the deed, recognize us as family, and know it belongs to them. It is a treasure trove of deep certainty, a light that the darkness has never put out. This thing that inspires our faith, this living thing, call it spirit, whatever, we can never figure it out fully. This thing is always waiting with us, walking with us, waking us to a life that is just a little bit ahead in spite of the war. Every waking child is keen for it, as keen as a child is on Christmas morning. And when we live it out faithfully in our time, we are putting the deed into the ground, a little boat sent down the river that a child way, way down the stream will draw out and in it find meaning.